This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 10th of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, Wisconsin Republicans, despite the absence of Democrats, managed to pass a bill that strips workers of collective bargaining rights.
If there's any doubt as to whether good cause exists, the governmental body should provide 24 hours notice. This is clearly a violation of open meetings law.
Congress member Peter King opens the first of his controversial hearings on the radicalization of American Muslims.
To back down would be a craven surrender to political correctness and an abdication of what I believe to be the main responsibility of this committee, to protect America from a terrorist attack.
And we go to a Benghazi detention center where authorities are holding Africans accused of being Gaddafi mercenaries. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Dalai Lama, who has been the spiritual and political leader of Tibet's government in exile for decades, said today he would relinquish his political role in the organization. Elections are scheduled when the exiled parliament convenes on March 14th. The Dalai Lama said he will cede power to the winner. He made the announcement on the 52nd anniversary of the Tibetan people's failed uprising against China, which led to the exile of the government. Possibly fearing another uprising, earlier this week, China restricted foreign travel to the region. In India, thousands demonstrated today in Hyderabad, the capital city of the southeastern coastal state of Andhra Pradesh. The demonstrators are continuing their four-decade call for the creation of a separate state called Telangana. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal has the story.
More than 15,000 protesters tried to break through barricades along the shores of Hussein Sagar Lake. The so-called Million March encountered tear gas shells and beating by a mammoth police force. The protesters set fire to two police vehicles and destroyed some statues. They want the government to immediately introduce a bill that would create a separate state. Shravan Kumar is the leader of one of the protesting groups, Telangana Rashtra Samiti.
Today thousands of people have marched ahead to the tank band. This is a very clear indication how deep-rooted, what the aspiration that the Telangana people have towards the state formation.
Traffic was diverted and about 47 trains coming to Hyderabad from various parts of the southern region were cancelled. The police detained thousands, including 50 members of the state legislative assembly. They held them in stadiums and public spaces, trying to keep them from joining the march, according to the BBC. 2 years back, the Indian government promised that a new state would be formed, but later said more talks were needed, causing widespread protests in the region. Jasvinder Sehgal, FSRN, India.
The Fatah Party in Gaza, along with some other PLO-linked political factions, are downplaying a Hamas initiative for national unity between Hamas and Fatah, saying it's nothing new. The initiative was announced amid growing social media calls for widespread protests next Tuesday. Organizers want the Palestinian parties to reconcile. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
This week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah reiterated a call for legislative and presidential elections. Abbas says a September vote could restore national unity on a democratic basis, but Hamas has rejected that call, in addition to a recent Egyptian unity plan. Its leaders want the two sides to reconcile before the elections, guaranteeing a place in the government. Mukhaymar Abu Seda is a Gaza-based political analyst.
It seems to me that the political divide is going to continue, and it doesn't seem there are great efforts, whether from the Palestinians themselves, from the Arab League, which is very much involved and busy with what is happening in the region now, that any initiative will be able to put an end to the political divide in the foreseeable future.
Meanwhile, Hamas announced today a cabinet reshuffle. It is being seen by many as an effort to quell possible anti-government sentiment that led to political upheaval in the region. Hamas says its new cabinet includes its first female minister and is dedicated to rearranging internal Palestinian affairs. Hamas also appointed a new foreign minister, its first since taking power 4 years ago. Rami Almagari, FSRN, Gaza.
Today, the White House hosted a conference on bullying prevention. It's the first of its kind to be hosted by the president.
Because putting a stop to bullying is a responsibility we all share.
Justin Patchen of the Cyberbullying Research Center told the crowd that about 45 states have anti-bullying laws, and 30 of those have cyberbullying provisions.
The problem I see with those laws, though, is this standpoint. Cyberbullying is a problem. Schools, you need to do something about it. And that's it. They don't say what they should do. They don't say how they should do it. They don't say anything about the circumstances under which they should intervene. And they certainly don't provide any resources to do it. So I think laws need to be updated to provide more tools for schools.
The White House is trying to raise the profile of the issue. Over the past couple years, there has been a string of teen suicides linked to bullying. One of the most recent was Minnesota teen Lance Lunston, whose friends say was bullied about his sexual orientation. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Demonstrators gathered outside the Wisconsin state capitol today following a controversial vote by Republicans that rammed through a bill stripping workers of their collective bargaining rights. More rallies are planned for the weekend, and high school students are calling for a nationwide walkout tomorrow. Molly Stentz of Word FM in Madison reports.
Republican Senate leadership decided to pass the anti-union bill Wednesday night, with or without the Democrats. With the 14 Senate Democrats still out of state, Republicans used a move they've been threatening for weeks, passing the legislation through a non-fiscal bill. Regular bills do not require the 3/5 quorum, which had been holding back passage of the controversial bill. They took the collective bargaining language out of the budget bill, put it in another bill, called a meeting, and then passed it, all within a few hours. During the conference committee meeting, Republicans took a vote over Representative Peter Barca's objections, the lone Democrat at the table.
Clerk, call the roll.
No, excuse me. No, listen, it says, if there's any doubt as to whether good cause exists, the governmental body should provide 24 hours notice. This is clearly a violation of the open meetings law. Now, look, you've been shutting people down. It is improper for you to move forward while this is a violation of the open meetings law. You're not allowing amendments. And that is wrong. Now, Mr. Chairman, this is a violation of law.
Democrats say Wisconsin law requires 24 hours notice prior to any legislative meeting, and they got less than 2 hours notice. They didn't receive copies of the bill prior to the meeting either. But both Republicans and the Senate chief clerk say that during a special session, no notice is required. The Capitol was locked at 6 p.m. just as the meeting began. Thousands had flocked to the building but were stuck outside, waiting to pass through security at the only door that was open. Some protesters, like Steve Chappelle of Madison, were able to sneak in through bathroom windows.
They had coordinated, I'm not sure how they did this, the unlocking of the bathroom window. We all had to climb over the bottom window, but once we had a full bathroom, the door was open into the Capitol and we stormed through.
Hundreds of protesters rallied inside the Capitol, just outside the Senate gallery doors, yelling and chanting. After the committee passed the new bill, it went to a full vote of the Senate. It passed on a vote of 18-1, with not a single Democrat present. When news of the Senate vote passed through the crowd, it erupted. Around this time, the main entrance doors to the Capitol were forced open by protesters. Thousands streamed in. Police abandoned their posts, and immediately, bedding, food, and musical instruments started pouring in through every door. Protesters called for everyone to stay all night, in defiance of the court order. Assembly Democrats are contemplating their next moves. Representative Kelda Hellenroys was outraged by the Republican maneuver.
Well, apparently for the last 50 years, Wisconsin must have been a pretty terrible place to live because they're determined to undo half a century of our history of workers having rights in the state. So that's the only emergency I can think of, other than the governor's falling poll numbers.
On Thursday morning, thousands have gathered outside the Capitol in protest. Reverend Jesse Jackson addressed the crowd locked outside.
46 years ago, we fought for the right to vote. Today we fight for workers to have a voice at the table. We fight today for collective bargaining.
Some Senate Democrats have announced they'll now return to Wisconsin. Rallies continue on Friday and over the weekend. A march of Milwaukee high school students and teachers will leave Friday morning and walk over 80 miles to the Capitol in Madison. With Joanne Powers, I'm Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
In Washington, D.C. today, New York Republican Peter King opened the first of his congressional hearings looking at what he calls the danger from the radicalization of American Muslims. Many Muslim Americans and civil liberties groups are concerned and upset by the way the hearings focus solely on the Muslim community. Matt Laszlo has this snapshot of the hearing and the brewing debate surrounding this controversial investigation.
Walking in the Cannon House office building this morning, it was obvious something big was about to happen. Dozens of TV camera crews and still photographers lined one wall because the hearing room was overflowing. Around the corner, more than 100 people waited patiently for a chance to attend, the majority to oppose the hearing. But the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Peter King of New York, said even in the face of loud opposition, he was moving ahead anyway.
Let me make it clear today that I remain convinced that these hearings must go forward. And they will. To back down would be a craven surrender to political correctness and an abdication of what I believe to be the main responsibility of this committee, to protect America from a terrorist attack.
The hearing raised the question, who or what is on trial? Many Democrats say they think Islam is.
I think religious freedom has an absolute place in America.
That's Benny Thompson, the top Democrat on the committee. In the wake of the deadly shooting in Tucson, Arizona, by a white male, and countless other acts of terror perpetrated by white radicals, Thompson argued the committee should broaden its investigation. He says honing in on one religious minority could have many unforeseen consequences.
We live in troubling times. I've heard concerns that today's hearing will stoke a climate of fear and distrust in the Muslim community. It may also increase the fear and distrust of the Muslim community. For law enforcement officials, outreach and cooperation may become more difficult.
But Republicans countered that the hearing was essential for protecting America. Virginia Republican Congressperson Frank Wolf testified.
We cannot ignore the phenomenon of domestic radicalization. It is a national security challenge that must be confronted.
The Republicans weren't alone. Some Muslim Americans testified too. Like Mzoudi Yasser, president and founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy.
The U.S. has a significant problem with Muslim radicalization. You know, listen, I'm Muslim, and I realize it's my problem, and I need to fix it, and that's what I'm trying to do. It's unfortunate that you have some of the best work on radicalization is being done by non-Muslims.
But outside the hearing, many Muslim Americans disagreed with Yasser's testimony, like Hindi Ali from Minnesota.
It sends the wrong message to everybody, and especially it might be used as a recruiting tool from Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab and so many different terroristic-like organizations, and then we just hope that it doesn't spread more Islamophobia, and then we just all Americans want to live safe in this country.
Mumin Bari is on the Muslim Council in Maryland. He says he's worried all the good work his group does could be swept to the wayside because of these hearings.
We do feed the homeless. We engage in food drives. We do a lot of other things, really, for the community. Because we're part of the community. We're fabric of this nation and this community.
Democrats on the committee say time would be better spent exploring other ways to keep the nation safe. Democratic Congressperson Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas.
We would be better off if we would have a hearing speaking about the importance of human intelligence, funding for the elements of the Department of Homeland Security that can work on human resources to be able to hear from individuals who do want to engage and help this country promote its values.
King says this is only the first in a series of hearings into radicalization of Muslims, though he hasn't announced the focus or the date of the next one. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
For reaction to today's hearing, we go to Faiza Patel, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. In a report titled Rethinking Radicalization, she's made recommendations to the federal government suggesting how it could recalibrate its approach to radicalization. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
First up, what do you think of these King hearings and what you heard this morning?
Well, I think the King hearings are basically quite misconceived. You know, yesterday's arrest of the man who tried to bomb the Martin Luther King Day parade earlier this year showed us very clearly that extremist violence comes in all stripes. And Sheriff Baca today also testified about this fact, that, you know, it's not just the Muslim community that's a problem. This is an issue that affects the country as a whole, and we should be looking at this issue from that perspective. Second of all, we know from top law enforcement officials, including from Attorney General Holder, who spoke about this yesterday, and statistics that Muslim Americans have stood really as a bulwark against terrorism. You know, they have reported some 40% of the tips that have thwarted terrorist plots have come from this community. So we should be very careful that we don't do things that alienate the community.
What do you think about the selection of witnesses for this hearing? Do you see them as representative of the American Muslim community and the sort of concerns that should come up in a debate like this?
I think that's a really important question, Danny. I mean, one of the things that is really disturbing about this hearing is the witnesses that the congressman has chosen. First of all, Dr. Jasser is, as we all know, a physician from Arizona. He has no deep expertise in the Muslim American community, and his voice is not likely to be representative of the community. Secondly, Congressman called two family members of Muslims who had been radicalized, as they say, or had committed terrorist acts. And while these people certainly have important stories and important experiences, they are, again, not experts in law enforcement. They are not experts in terrorism. They are not experts in radicalization. What we should have is more people like Sheriff Baca, who was called by the Democrats, who can give us real-world experience and not just anecdotal evidence about terrorism, but a breadth of experience on this issue.
You write about the dangers of a reductionist view about how people become terrorists. Could you explain that and what can be done to counteract that?
So what I'm really concerned about is the fact that some law enforcement agencies, and here I talk about the NYPD and the FBI in particular, have taken on this trajectory of radicalization point of view. And what this does is it suggests that the radicalization is a conveyor belt. You start with a disaffected population who adopts, some of whom adopt extremist religious views, become religious, and the next thing they know, they're strapping a bomb on themselves and committing a terrorist act. But what the problem with this theory is that it's simply not borne out by social science and government research. You know, the Department of Defense here in the United States, in response to the Fort Hood attack, did a literature survey on these issues, and it concluded that violence is really, really difficult to predict. And in the specific context of terrorism and terrorism that's conducted in the name of Islam, MI5, for example, has done a study which really cautions against viewing terrorism as a trajectory or a conveyor belt that leads from religion to violence. There's not necessarily such a direct connection between words and deeds. It's a tenuous connection. And so what we suggest is that instead of focusing on religiosity as a sign of impending terrorism, that law enforcement should be focusing on the point at which people take concrete steps towards violence. You know, the most recent studies indicate that about 80% of terrorist plots were foiled due to smart police work. And I think that's what we know works, and that's where we should be focusing our energies.
In your report, where you make these specific recommendations, you talk about establishing a mechanism to evaluate the effectiveness of anti-radicalization measures that are being used by law enforcement agencies. What sort of mechanism are you talking about there?
Well, you know, one of the things, and this criticism has been levied from all sides of the aisle on this issue, is that our response to radicalization is not coordinated or coherent. And that's true. You do have many efforts going on. You have the Department of Homeland Security doing some things. You have the law enforcement and intelligence collection apparatus doing other things. You have local law enforcement doing other things. And what I think is that, you know, we should have a real discussion about which of these mechanisms are actually effective. Sheriff Bakar testified today about his experience as to what was effective. You know, maybe we can look to examples such as his as best practices in this area. And we also really need to look at whether or not you can actually pair community outreach with really intelligence gathering focus of the response to radicalization. Are those two things really compatible? That's the kind of question that the government should really be looking at.
Faiza Patel, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. Bye-bye.
In Libya, news reports say opposition forces are fleeing the oil town of Ras Lanuf and coming under sustained attacks at the town's western limits from rockets, shells, and gunboats firing at them from the sea. The reports quote both fleeing rebels and state television. As the US and the European Union continue to debate military intervention and whether to enforce a no-fly zone, France has become the first country to formally recognize Libya's National Council in Benghazi. Meanwhile, there are ongoing concerns about the plight of thousands of African migrant workers in Libya who are trying to flee the country. Some are being detained by rebels who accuse them of being mercenaries hired by Gaddafi. In comments to the international media, Peter Bouquet, who is in Libya with a team from Human Rights Watch, said he had found no proof that Gaddafi was using foreign African mercenaries and that rumours about mercenaries were creating hysteria and even leading to lynchings of innocent migrants. FSRN's Raphael Kraft is in Benghazi. He's been investigating the fate of alleged African mercenaries detained by the Libyan National Council.
The atmosphere is chaotic here in Benghazi's tribunal. The smell of coffee and cigarettes fills the main floor corridor as people strapped with Kalashnikov run from door to door, some emerging from long meetings, others waiting for Benghazi's new leaders to respond to inquiries and make decisions. The building hosts the Libyan National Council, and on the upper floors, the Justice Department. Authorities are holding a number of prisoners here, including 20 suspected mercenaries. As I wait to speak to the Attorney General, a young tribunal volunteer asked me, "Why are you interested in the mercenaries' cases? What is your interest in seeing them? Everybody knows they are mercenaries." I just want to know if they are well treated, I answer.
We treat them according to Geneva treatment.
We treated them according to Geneva agreement. We give them all they need. Toothpaste, soap, everything they need. They are treated in the hospitals if they are wounded. I am the man in charge of that.
We eventually speak to Karima Musa, the general attorney, but she refuses to be recorded. She says inquiry about each one of the presumed mercenaries is ongoing, that they will be given a lawyer and tried when the situation stabilizes. Musa grants me permission to talk to the prisoners for 10 minutes and ask a volunteer to take me upstairs to see them. On the roof of the tribunal, 10 men, some lying on mattresses, wait for their cells to be cleaned. Wrapped in blankets, the men stare into the distance with blank faces. They come from Chad, Niger, and Mali. They all deny being mercenaries. Yehuda Latangra is a Malian citizen who has been held here for 2 weeks.
They caught me as I went to do some shopping. They asked for my passport. I gave it to them. They asked for my residence permit, and because I didn't have one, they brought me here. We lack food here. We only eat bread. We are exhausted. We are just poor people who came to Libya to make a bit of money.
Yehuda Latangra says he was working on building water pipelines, but Libyan National Council authorities suspect he is a mercenary because he was found 60 miles from his work site. Tangra says he had left his job to find a new one in the region of Benghazi. Another prisoner, Boubacar, comes from Niger.
The Libyans hit me here when they caught me.
Did they hit you here in jail or outside?
No, outside when they caught me. They cut the vein here in my shoulder.
Can you show me?
Yes, of course. See?
It is a bayonet wound. Are there other prisoners, or are there just 10 of you here?
Well, I cannot say. I don't know.
Okay. Where are the 10 other presumed mercenaries? The interim authorities refused to take us to them, nor would they say whether the prisoners denied being mercenaries. The Attorney General said the interim authorities are protecting this man, and they are safer here in jail than in the streets. Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Benghazi.
As violence continues in Ivory Coast, human rights advocates are warning of a massive humanitarian crisis. Incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo remains defiant, refusing to cede victory to the recognized winner, Alassane Ouattara. UN Radio's Jerry Adams reports.
Adrian Edwards of UNHCR, the UN refugee agency, says UNHCR is appealing to the warring groups in Cote d'Ivoire to commit themselves to support urgently needed humanitarian assistance. He describes how serious the situation is, with thousands of people still holed up in Abidjan in community centers.
As of Monday, an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 people are now displaced in Abidjan, and a further at least 70,000 people displaced in the country's west. In both cases, a result of recent and ongoing fighting.
Gemini Pandya of the International Organization for Migration says an estimated 450,000 people are thought to be displaced by the growing unrest in the country.
In the west of the country, where IOM is the only aid agency still operating in Dueke and Guiglo, and has up until now been the only link from the field to the humanitarian community outside, another 70,000 people are still displaced. However, the fighting between rival forces at Toulpleu, this means that this figure has not only led to more people being displaced, but we're also seeing high levels of secondary displacement.
Ms. Pandya says the situation has deteriorated to the point where IOM has evacuated its international staff from Western Cote d'Ivoire for security reasons. Meanwhile, as many of the injured in the ongoing conflict do not have access to adequate health care, the World Health Organization, WHO, is monitoring the situation. Fadela Chaib is with WHO.
Something like 4,000 patients were treated at the border between Libya and Tunisia, and mainly for injuries and diarrhea and influenza-like diseases. So we can understand that because it's cold at night in this part of the world and people are mainly suffering from different type of diarrhea and also influenza-like diseases.
Ms. Chaib says no outbreaks of disease have been reported, but when WHO is able to gain access to the wounded, the organization will follow these priorities.
Our main priorities will be to be able to help in triage, trauma care, and medical evacuation if need be, and also, very importantly, to be able to strengthen and establish an early warning system to be able to detect very early any outbreak of diseases.
Members of the UN Security Council have also expressed concern about the increasing number of refugees and internally displaced persons caused by this violence.
That was UN Radio's Jerry Adams reporting. And that's today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham and Jane Chang. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.